Welcome to History 101, Lecture 18, Factories and Slaves. As we saw in our previous lecture, the period of global warming after 1720 ushered in a renewed period of rapid economic growth worldwide, comparable to that of the Bronze Age, of the early Iron Age, and to the high medieval one. Economic growth, driven in the first instance by global population growth and by the extension of the agricultural areal, by ruthless exploitation of natural resources, and by a plethora of new technical inventions. During the high medieval boom, these technical inventions were mainly invented in the most technologically advanced society of the age, southern China, and they were then rapidly diffused to places close by, and very slowly and gradually to more distant places, and that revolutionized trade and production there too. Thus, for example, the magnetic compass that had been invented in China somewhere around the 1st century Common Era, diffused by the 12th century to Europe, and made possible the revolution in medieval trade that I alluded to already, namely the establishment of direct sailing links between southern Europe and the Baltic. Very similarly so, England, and then the Western European countries and the USA, made a couple of inventions in the 19th century, which then gradually diffused to elsewhere. In fact, it is a process we are still in. Industrial technology was first adopted in Europe and in the USA, and it is now slowly diffusing to China, India, and perhaps very lately to West Africa. Such a process is fairly common throughout world history. The problem with the 19th and 20th century is that we are still so close to it in time that we tend to assume we are witnessing unprecedented and historically completely unique changes. Yet, as I said before, had some Italian in 1430 been asked about his own age, he would have told you he was undergoing historically unique and unprecedented changes. On top of this, particularly if it comes to the Industrial Revolution, or the break into the fossil fuel age, there is a thicket of Whig and nationalist preconceptions and prejudices to slash through. For to the Englishman, the supposed fact that they were the very harbingers of modernity is irrefutable proof that Englishmen are way superior to foreigners. As soon as any Englishman starts to talk about only in England, you'd better watch out, because then the nationalist Whig comes out. The modern multicultural USA's variety on this peculiar form of nationalism is the argument that the West, that is the USA, and the free world, as they used to say in the Cold War, from which this word derives, is way superior to what is then called the East. Broadly everything beyond the Oder River, right up to the Aleuts, and so on to Morocco, and what I might call the Souths, backward southern Europe, is one South, everything African is another, worser South, and everything south of the Rio Grande is surely the worst South. There has recently been a reaction to this hallowed Western supremacy argument, that was obviously prompted by the recent economic boom in China, that is known as the California School of Economic Historians. They argue that China and Japan were in the 18th century economically just as advanced as Europe, and that if one wants to explain the so-called great divergence between Europe and Asia, broad cultural or broad geographical explanations will simply get you nowhere. For if Chinese culture was retrograde and opposed to capitalism or to industrial progress in comparison to progressive England or the West, so that China should have been forever doomed to backwardness, how comes it is now suddenly booming? And the argument for Western superiority, of course, never quite fitted Japan. Now, the conundrum of the California school is not a new conundrum, because back in the early 60s, everybody assumed that the USSR was going to economically overtake the United States of America soon. In that period, it seemed as if countries clearly did not have to imitate United States institutions or United States culture for economic success. And the economic advisor to the Kennedy government, Walt Rostow, and emigre Russian economist Simon Kuznets, then both argued that in view of this rapid growth of the USSR, economists should focus on economic rather than on fake cultural or general attitude preconditions to economic growth. For Rostov said at the time that what the USSR could do, a whole group of other countries might do as well, such as Brazil, China or India. Now Rostov distinguished four preconditions to the British Industrial Revolution, and I may add two. First, productive agriculture, an agriculture that produces sufficient food to feed the population, and is sufficiently productive to allow for a large part of the population to migrate to cities. It surely helps too if that agriculture is able to produce surpluses to obtain funds to invest in industrialization. Second, investments in infrastructure that allow for creating both a national and an international market for products. For example, by the 18th century, Britain had a system of canals and of turnpike, that is, toll roads, allowing products from, say, the Midlands to be easily fetched to London. In contemporary Mozambique, in contrast, everything had to be transported through wild bush on the heads of carriers. This is obviously a far from ideal situation if you want to build a factory. Then, capital is needed, for which Rostow fixed on a 5% savings rate, and finally a positive attitude towards science and technological advances is needed. Let me add two more conditions. You need a government too that is positively inclined towards indigenous economic growth. Few or no governments will of course nowadays say they are not positively inclined towards economic growth. The last ruler, who resolutely said he would prohibit any form of godless modernity, whether it be newspapers, pens, TVs, dancing, medicine in yards or factories, was Sultan Said bin Tamur of Oman, who was toppled by his son, Qaboos bin Said, in 1970. However, a major problem all colonies in the 19th century, and so up to the 1960s, were faced with, was that the governments of colonies were all for economic growth and for modernity, but only on condition it benefited industries and traders from their own country, and it should in no way benefit the ones of the colony. And relying entirely on foreign capital for your economic development is risky, because those foreign entrepreneurs want to stay in your country for a while, make as much money as possible there, as soon as possible, and then will remit it all to bank accounts in their home country. Also, you need a government that is willing to aid and to protect nascent industries. This was again a major problem in colonies, since colonial governments saw any native firm as a potential competitor to firms from their home country, and they did everything in their power to discourage native entrepreneurs. So, following Rostow then, what were the main reasons why the West in general, and England in particular, were the first to industrialize? Now, the first reason is broadly institutional, cultural, and may apply to Europe as a whole rather than to England. It may, if you like it, even be broadly be traced back to the Renaissance, and if you like it again, to Leonardo da Vinci. Namely that Europeans, indeed since the Renaissance, have had big fun tinkering with machines and mechanical contraptions. Most of these machines were obviously utterly useless. as in the famous search for the Perpetuum Mobile, or with virtually all the machines that were designed by Leonardo da Vinci, since, after a myriad attempts to reconstruct them, there was a whole TV series on this on National Geographic, they all proved either completely unworkable or completely impossible to construct. To give some further examples of completely useless inventions, the submarine was patented in 1780, but not much came of it. The machine gun was patented in 1770, and in fact, the medieval organ gun was already a kind of completely unworkable machine gun. Yet a few of these gadgets were indeed to prove critical for the Industrial Revolution. The idea of a steam engine goes back all the way to the ancient Greeks, and the design itself was already patented in 1602. However, nobody then did anything with that design for another century and a half. Now, Europeans recalled all those mechanical contraptions of them in masses to Oriental courts. But with the exception of clocks that were made by Armenians in Iran too, and a few astronomical devices, these were mostly seen as funny local gadgets which nobody there tried to copy, as they were rated on a par with such other gadgets as curiously barking toy dogs from Nuremberg or wax statues of women that were nearly as popular as the most popular gift, the telescope. For example, in 1705, the Dutch gave a complete set of scientific equipment, microscopes, instructions how to build microscopes, glasses for microscopes, to the Mughal governor of Surat. Apparently, he was interested in the newest scientific discoveries. But the Ahmed Khan does not even seem to have had the idea to commission somebody to make microscopes himself. The East was not technologically stagnant, even in the 18th century. There were advances in porcelain and jade manufacturing in China, whereas Iran put up an entirely new porcelain manufacturing in the 17th century and a new glassmaking industry as well. Yet, excepting clocks, some weapons and guns, nobody appears to have been very much interested in copying Western machinery. Now, what were all these funny Western machines primarily designed for? Well, some of it was used in mining, some of it was used in weaving. As I said before, Lombard weavers already used very sophisticated machines in the 16th century, and the Industrial Revolution might well have happened in Lombardy in the 16th century. Yet these machines and inventions were mostly related to two other pursuits. To warfare. Leonardo da Vinci was a famous artist in his time, but he was actually paid as a military engineer who was to redesign the fortifications of Milan, while the development of mathematics in Europe was in the 16th and 17th century very closely related to ballistics, counting the movement of a cannonball in flight. And technological and scientific inventions were, critically, closely linked to seafaring. Astronomy is a rather recondite and useless pursuit on land. It is, however, critical at sea, and particularly on the open oceans, as you have to fix your position by the stars, and Europeans were crossing the open oceans, and badly charted open oceans, by the hundreds of thousands by the 18th century, unlike the Chinese. Whereas the telescope is of very little use on land, but is critical at sea, as you have to discern submerged sandbanks from as long a distance as possible. In other words, the increasing use of machinery was related to the chronic interstate warfare of the 17th and 18th centuries, and it was linked to the discoveries. Yet, to some extent, this delight in tinkering with machines has also to do with patent law that was invented in Italy in the 16th century and by which an invention became the property of its inventor. This can be somewhat of a two-edged sword. One problem in introducing the steam engine in factories in the early Industrial Revolution was that James Watt sat on his patent for his perfected steam engine and immediately sued anybody who had the temerity to use it. Lawsuits that finally cost him so much that he nearly made a loss on his engine. Yet it is undeniable that the early pioneers of the Industrial Revolution tinkered with their machines in the hope of getting rich by it. And Richard Arkwright, who had started as a barber, became, after endless proceedings in court against anybody who wanted to steal his patent, indeed one of the richest men in England, owning 6 factories. A contemporary story told that, staying in London, he met a nobleman who asked him whether he had not once been a barber. "Sir," Arkwright responded, "I was once a barber, and I'm apt to conclude, had your lordship been a barber, you would have continued a barber still." Yet people in other countries were tempted to get rich by patent law too. And it is indeed not too far-fetched to say that, had the British capitalists chosen to primarily concentrate on trade and let manufacturing languish or decline, as the Dutch ones did in the course of the 18th century, the Industrial Revolution might just as well have occurred 10 or 20 years later elsewhere. Good candidates are France, that was technologically as sophisticated as Britain, and that in some branches of technical knowledge, such as chemistry, was ahead of Britain, or above all, the United States. For the United States was in urgent need of replacing its expensive manpower with as much machines as possible. And the United States, furthermore, had particularly easy access to the latest technology. For technology in the early Industrial Revolution was not really that terribly complicated. The BBC used for decades to run a show by Fred Deepner, who within 20 minutes could enthusiastically explain how some steam engine contraption worked. I doubt whether even Fred Deepner could have explained in 20 minutes how a laser works, even though every girl behind the counter uses it the whole day without even having a clue how it works. So industrial espionage was already becoming an issue in the late 18th century. The French, the Russian and the Prussian governments all paid informers to keep close tabs on the newest machinery in use in Britain. And they tried to lure experienced craftsmen from Britain to put up their own factories. Josiah Wedgwood used to closely screen the hordes of visitors visiting his factory where his patent porcelain was made, as he feared most of them were industrial spies. Yet for few countries, pirating English technology was as easy as it was for the United States. For although England had strictly prohibited the emigration of skilled English craftsmen, Samuel Slater, who put up the first American textile factory on Rhode Island in 1790, was an engineer who had worked in Arkwright's factory. As the entire technology of the steam engine or of mechanical loom was not that terribly complicated, and the rough theoretic principles of it were known for 1.5 centuries, had Arkwright failed with his factory, Slater might have established one instead. While the first factory using the pirated mill jenny was already established in France in 1771, 8 years after the first English one. In India and China, on the other hand, this had to wait for another century. Location was critical for the early Industrial Revolution. There were, after all, hordes of Frenchmen around in England, but there weren't that many Chinese, and so the French could far more easily pirate technology than could the Chinese. Japan, later on, in the 70s and the 80s of the 19th century, found a way around this problem by lavishly paying American universities if they but accepted so-called Japanese students who were really industrial spies. Yet this was not yet an option open in the 18th century. Aside from this, you need a strong tradition of mechanical engineering. This is rather easy to understand. Steam machines were very fragile machines that broke down a lot, and you need skilled craftsmen to build precision screws or valves for these dimensions. And the English had precisely such a tradition of skilled precision metal manufacturing in Sheffield. If we now come to what were the specific English factors which made England the first industrial nation, the first reason is actually the simplest, namely that England is quite a small place, and that it is an island with no place further than 200 miles from the coast. Now in the 16th century already, as England began to run out of wood for charcoal, the English had shifted to using coal for heating houses. By the 18th century, this was a huge industry, involving hundreds of thousands of workers, both in digging for coal as in transporting coal. Yet as those mines were often flooded, Thomas Newcomen perfected in 1712 an engine that was so far used for extinguishing fires that he called the steam engine, or, at first, a more or less an 18th century invention, the miner's friend, though as it consumed far too much coal and constantly exploded, only one was in use for 30 years. That coal was then fetched from the mines by lorries over iron tracks to the sea. Just put a steam engine on those lorries and you have a railroad. And it was then fetched to the cities by sea. For, and here was another critical advantage of England, all its coal deposits are located very close to the sea. Had it all to be fetched over land, the coal would have been prohibitively expensive. It is hence also no coincidence that the next European country to industrialize was another small country with large deposits of coal that could easily be transported by river and that had a tradition of metalworking going back for 1,000 years besides, namely Belgium and Wallonia in particular. The third factor economic historians commonly adduce is the so-called agrarian revolution that had supposedly made English agriculture to the most productive in all of Europe. As I said repeatedly, it is doubtful whether English agriculture was really that much more productive than elsewhere. Yet what the English landlords, followed by their Irish and Scottish colleagues, had surely very efficiently done was to virtually destroy the English and the Scottish and Irish later on peasantry. With the Enclosure Acts, as the co-inventor, together with Charles Darwin, of the theory of natural selection, Russell Wallace put it, those Enclosure Acts put in place, quote, an all-embracing system of land robbery of the poor by the already rich, for which nothing is too small. It has absorbed meadows and forests, moors and mountains, it has appropriated lakes and rivers and the fish that swim in them. It makes agriculturalists pay for seaweed meadows and fishermen for their bait. And it has devastated whole countries to be replaced by sheep and cattle. It was a comprehensive privatization of land, in other words, in which the agricultural laborers were deprived of hearth, houses, and fields without any compensation, and were then either forced to move to the cities to swell the ranks of poor people seeking employ in factories, or else they might land up in workhouses provided under the poor law. And conditions in workhouses were commonly even worse than in the very worst factories, while they had to sweat all day with merely some food as pay. A typical poor house is depicted in that perpetual classic, Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens. And if you, as an English worker, did not want to work in factories, then there were always plenty of Irish men available to take your place, as they lived in even worse conditions and would accept even lower wages than you. Now, this was exactly the kind of thing, barefooted robbery of the peasants by the nobles, that the French Revolution had opposed. And hence, the French peasants were far less willing to abandon their hard-fought-for piece of land, however small it was, to swell the ranks of the urban proletariat. For you had to be pretty direly pressed indeed to go to work in a factory in the early Industrial Revolution. In Manchester, Workers had to go to work at 5 o'clock in the morning. They had then an hour lunch break at 12, and then they had to work until 9 o'clock in the evening. Their food consisted only of potatoes, a little bread and tea, and most got paid far too little to ever afford meat. In addition to which, workers not only had to work in incredible noise and in great heat, for the temperature in an average factory was 30 degrees centigrade, but they had to work in an extremely polluted environment as well, full of dangerous gases and noxious dust particles. Small wonder then that the average life expectancy of a poor person in rural England in the early 19th century was 35, and that for factory workers in Manchester it was 17. To all this must still be added that steam machines were very dangerous machines with constant accidents, and there was no form of social insurance for work at all, until the workers began to provide it for themselves by way of so-called friendly societies, where they laid part of their salary aside in order to pool their resources to provide for small handouts to people who had become disabled due to workplace injuries. In addition to all that, of course, the early factories employed child labor and women, who had commonly to work in even more gruesome conditions than the men did. And even in the early 20th century, working in a factory was still far more likely to get you dead or wounded than enlisting in the English army. I won't even speak about mines here. And to repeat, all that for a pittance. There has been a very long debate on whether the standard of living of the English working class improved or deteriorated during the Industrial Revolution. There are pessimists who point out that pay hardly increased in factories for the period from 1780 to 1850 at all, and there are optimists who say that the prices of victuals dropped so that workers could afford marginally more goods in 1850 than they could in 1780. Yet, even if the optimists are right, one still wonders whether that workers could now afford to eat some meat weekly instead of monthly was really a compensation for the gruesome work they had to perform. Admittedly, and famously, by the 1830s, primarily spurred by the church, which was worried by the moral degeneration of children and women in the factories, and that might breed atheism, and always against bitter resistance of the mill owners, Parliament moved to curtail the number of hours worked in the factories for children, and it curtailed the number of hours worked by women in 1850. Yet there were still no regulations for adult men whatsoever until the 1860s. Small wonder, then, that Russia's national poet, Alexander Pushkin, wrote in 1820, "If you read the complaints of the English factory workers, your hair will stand from fright. So many repulsive tortures, so many incomprehensible suffering, what cold barbarity, what dreadful poverty. And it is all not an abuse, but is within the strict limits of the law. We in Russia," he pursued, "fortunately have nothing similar. And indeed, if we call by body hate, to some extent, a measurement of physical well-being, Russian serfs were commonly far better off than English factory workers." Next to coal and the dispossessed working class, the fourth factor required for the Industrial Revolution was capital. Now, in principle, not that much capital was needed to enter industry. There were relatively few purpose-built cotton mills before 1815, and a cotton trader of even modest means could rent a second-hand corn mill or a converted house. Venture capital could be provided by a sleeping partner, often working in the same field, who could bring the firm not only fresh capital, but perhaps some technological knowledge as well, and an order book. Katrina Honeyman's analysis shows that in 1787, only 26% of Lancaster's factory owners belong to social class 1, merchants, bankers, or nobility. An overwhelming 64% of them were in class 2, self-made artisans. Derbyshire recorded 38 and 57%, Nottinghamshire 40 and 46%. Out of 92 Lancashire mill owners, 65 had previously been in textiles. Most had been moderately successful owners of workshops. And this still remained the case a quarter of a century later. There was some upward mobility, but few made it from bottom to top. Indeed, the true English elite, the bankers, the gentlemen merchants, and of course the landed gentry, continued to snub the new industrial bourgeoisie of Manchester. To them, industry was a vile and mechanical world, as they said. And these manufacturers had no good manners, no good breeding, or did not go to boarding school, which became, in the 19th century, the way of the older British elites to fence themselves off from newcomers. Practically the only way for a newly rich manufacturer to get accepted by the British elite was buying some land and then hope that his daughter or granddaughter might one day snare some impoverished nobleman. A lot of English Whig writers, or for that matter writers on the Western Miracle, like to say that England was by the 18th century a uniquely open middle-class society. In fact, even the main specialist on the British aristocracy, David Cannadine, loves to argue so. Yet the ladies in Mansfield Park, which mind you takes place in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, would not even have mingled with lowly manufacturer, let alone they would ever marry one. Yet if initially the sums required for the Industrial Revolution were not that large, by 1850 the total investment in the cotton mills still amounted to a staggering 1.2 billion sterling, a third of the value of the entire British gross national product. And such a massive investment was at that moment really only possible in Britain. It was far in excess of what Germany or even France could have afforded. There were in England, thus, more than sufficient wealthy people to finance an economic effort far in excess of the modest financial requirements of the leaders of the Industrial Revolution. And the reservoir of savings in Britain was large enough to lead some of it into business. For, as the richest man of the age, Nathaniel Rothschild, used to say, there were three pursuits likely to get you broke: women, gambling, and engineers with beautiful plans to put up factories. Only with this third, you're sure to lose your money, he warned potential investors. In fact, the last thing was likely a major factor impeding industrialization of the Netherlands. It was a country with as high a per capita income as England, as productive in agriculture, and as many poor as England. And it could easily have bought or stolen technology, or could have found some Englishmen willing to start up industry. After all, Belgian industry was started by the Scottish emigre John Cockerill, who started a steam engine factory in Verviers in 1797. Yet Rotterdam and Amsterdam bankers and merchants were throughout more interested in investing in trade. In fact, they were still not much interested in industry right up to the 1850s, so that the first Dutch textile factories were largely financed by German entrepreneurs, and textile factories were initially located in Enschede, on the German border. English bankers too might probably have invested in women or in the slave trade or the East India Company rather than in manufacturing. Yet there would not have been so many rich people without the East India Company or the slave trade. A very long time ago, back in 1943, the later First Prime Minister of Guyana, Eric Williams, wrote a thesis he called capitalism and slavery. In that thesis, he argued that much of the capital to finance the Industrial Revolution was originally derived from the slave trade. This is a book against which economic historians have now been rallying for 70 years. Yet Williams was stating a rather obvious fact. As I've said repeatedly, the West Indian trade was the mainstay of British trade, and it was by far the most profitable as well. And because so much capital in England was gradually being accumulated, interest rates in England were the lowest in the world. It was 4% in 1770, 5% in 1800, where the massive lending of the British state to finance the war against Napoleon drove up rates, 4% in 1820, 3% in 1850, and 2% by 1860. Over the same period in France, it was 7, 9, and 5, and still 5 in 1860. In Berlin, it was 7, 9, 7, and 5, while in Russia, rates were seldomly below 10 or 12%. In other words, only England had the capital available to invest up to a third of its national income in factories. Yet what ultimately enabled those low interest rates, as I argued before, was the Brazilian gold flowing into Britain. So Brazil ultimately financed the Industrial Revolution. Now, this is a commonplace in the literature on Brazil, but Brazilian gold is completely ignored in that on the English Industrial Revolution. The fifth factor were the domestic and foreign markets for goods, and here the role of the state was absolutely essential. Now, on the one hand, there is this view, widely held amongst the Rise of the West apologists, that what explains the rise of England, or indeed of the West, was that the state, but that meant the English state, did not intervene in the market, and that it therefore offered ample leeway for free initiative, contrary to those Asian despotisms or all that stupid economic bungling of Louis XVI or a Maria Theresa, such as that stupid factory she established in Leeds. And on the other hand, there is that book, which they then constantly quote in support, and that was actually written during the Industrial Revolution. It is of course called The Wealth of Nations, of one Adam Smith. And Adam Smith indeed made a prolonged plaidoyer for free trade, as opposed to any form of government monopoly or government promotion of sales. Now, what most avid readers of that book apparently do not note was what this book was directed against. The Wealth of Nations was not a denunciation of, say, the economic policy of North Korea in 2015. It was rather one of the English state during the Industrial Revolution. For in fact, very few countries, and likely no country in Smith's days, was as aggressively pursuing a government policy of plucking domestic manufacturers by prohibitive import duties and allotting government subsidies to sales of goods abroad than England was. For example, the East India Company was by law required to export British goods, while the English, under the Navigation Law, had a policy of prohibiting exports of English manufactured goods on foreign ships. This gave them, for example, the right, they said, to search non-English ships in India in neutral Mughal ports on contraband and confiscate these ships if they were carrying English goods. In fact, the true free trading nation of that century, the Dutch, were increasingly being bested by aggressive British competition. The British dumped goods, the Dutch complained. They counterfeited Dutch designs, or they would systematically charge below cost prices for shipping, with all the risk for their ship owners them being bailed out by some semi-government monopoly organization, such as the Levant Company or the East India Company. Precisely the same litany of complaints you would nowadays hear about the Chinese, of course. Though not even China would be as bold as to resort to allowing exports of Chinese goods only on Chinese ships or only on Chinese aircraft. Far from following Smith's pious injunctions, the British state, however, followed an aggressive policy of furthering its own trade, and that meant the Liverpool, the London or the Glasgow trade, and excluding everybody else, the North American colonists included, as we saw already. In fact, the British state only bettered its ways in the way Smith had recommended in the 1830s, when British industrial supremacy was for the time being assured, and any further aggressive protection was no longer needed. For, as the British government well realized in the 1780s, had the British government actually done what Smith had recommended, the British would have been undersold by French or Indian competition. Yet, and that is the fifth point which makes the British distinctive, the best way of plucking British commerce and British navigation was, of course, the British Empire. And it is also pretty obvious that what made Britain unique during the Industrial Revolution was the Empire. Now, as said, the consensus is nowadays Patrick O'Brien's conclusion that the colonial periphery was peripheral to Europe. That dictum, ironically, is in turn largely founded on an old book by Ralph Davies on the incomes of the British custom revenues in the 18th century. And that book shows precisely the opposite to what O'Brien argues. During the period of the Industrial Revolution, from 1770 to roughly 1820, 60-70% of all British trade went to the colonies. In fact, during the period of Napoleon's continental blockade, 90% may have gone to markets beyond Europe. Now, in response, O'Brien would then say, this may all well be true, but foreign trade was only a very small part of British national income, perhaps 8-9%. That rose to 15% after 1810 and to 17% around 1850, and then it leapt to 20% in 1900, the highest any economy has ever achieved. Yet, though that percentage of 8% was a record for all of Europe, the Netherlands and Portugal, if you count Brazil in, as a foreign country excepted, where it might have been as much as 20%, for France it would have been something like 4%, and for Russia perhaps 2%. Nonetheless, British manufacturing thus indeed mainly worked for the internal market. Now, another English historian, Maxime Burke, has written a book called The Age of Manufacturing, about the age of the Industrial Revolution, that is completely off the mark, as he argues that by 1840, England was not an industrial economy, as rather one dominated by small workshops, and in which machines were applied in only a few sectors, whereas the small workshops were the really dynamic sector. However, what Burke is undoubtedly right in is that most manufacturing for the domestic market was still taking place in very small workshops, and it was all made by hand, for the rather simple reason that most things made for the domestic market could not be made by machines. Hats, suits, clothes, shoes, and so on. Indeed, manufacturing household utensils by machines was only to come in the early 20th century. The Industrial Revolution in Britain, however, was not led by those small workshops so dear to Burke. It was rather led by factories. Those factories were working for the foreign markets, and it was led by two sectors in particular. Iron, but above all by cotton, and more than half of that was sold abroad. In figures, in 1760, British cotton exports were worth 240,000 sterling, less than 4% of British trade. In 1800, they were worth 4 million sterling. In 1820, 16 million sterling, 20% of British trade. And in 1860, they were worth 40 million sterling. That's half of the entire British trade. In 1760, there were no factories. In 1800, there were 200. In 1820, there were 1,000. In 1860, there were 2,000. They employed 500,000 people. or 26% of all people of the entire workforce. So, cottons were the leading sector in the Industrial Revolution. That cotton became the lead sector of the Industrial Revolution is to some extent because cotton consists of strong fibers, easily worked by machine, while working wool with a machine is still a nightmare. Yet, there is one rather odd thing about cotton. It namely does not grow in England, where there are by contrast quite a lot of sheep, so that, for other obvious reasons, England has made woolen cloth for thousands of years, and woolen cloth was still by far its most important export in the 17th century. Cotton, however, was a newcomer. The first cotton manufacturers were only established in Manchester in the late 17th century. And the other odd thing about cotton, why wear cotton if you are a flax and wool producing country? As I said earlier, these cotton manufacturers were therefore not working for the English, as rather for two colonial markets, Africa and the Caribbean, as for obvious reasons, neither wool nor flax are particularly fit clothing yourselves in the tropics, and very much in particular, these cotton manufacturers were working for the slaves, because their masters were still wont to their decorum to dress as much in heavy, uncomfortable woolen clothes as they could. Yet Manchester mainly exported imitation Indian cotton textiles to West Africa, which traditionally had a good vend there. About 40-60% of the value of goods exported to West Africa consisted of textiles. Half of those were in the second half of the 18th century made up of Indian textiles, half by Manchester imitations of Indian textiles. But after 1760, the Manchester cotton manufacturers were facing an acute crisis, since after the East India Company had obtained the Diwani I discussed earlier over Bengal, it invested part of its tax revenue in cotton goods that were virtually free, as the weavers made them to pay their taxes. Given this devastating competition, if they had stuck to looms that were no different than Indian looms, the entire English cotton manufacturing would have gone under, lest it found some way of both drastically speeding up the production and cutting the wages. Those manufacturers first used James Hargrave's spinning jenny and then Richard Arkwright's improved water frame spinning jenny. Now, as that was powered by James Watt's improved steam engine by 1800, hand weavers could not keep pace anymore with machines. A steam loom weaver could in 1800 produce 7 pieces of textiles in the very same time it took a hand loom weaver to make 2. In 1840, that was 816. Despite its low wages, Bengal could thus not compete with Manchester anymore. And so, a steady stream of wealth came pouring forth from Manchester. It was the world's first industrial landscape, and the Count of Tocqueville, better known for his book about democracy in America, so far from a former rabid socialist, who visited it in 1832, described it as follows, and this merits a long quotation. It is an undulating plain, or rather a collection of little hills. On this watery land, which nature and art have contributed to keep damp, are scattered palaces and hovels. 30 or 40 factories rise on the top of hills. The wretched dwellings of the poor are scattered haphazard around them. Round them stretches land uncultivated, but without the charm of rustic nature, and without the amenities of a town. The soil has been taken away, scratched and torn up in 1,000 places, but it is not yet covered with the habitations of men. The land is given over to industry's use. Heaps of dung, rubble from buildings, putrid, stagnant pools are everywhere. The fetid, muddy water, stained with 1,000 colors by the factories that pass, or one of the streams, wander slowly around this refuge of poverty. They are nowhere kept in place by quays. Houses are built haphazard on their banks. Look up, and around this place you will see the huge palaces of industry. You will hear the noise of furnaces, the whistle of steam, These vast structures keep air and light out of the human habitations which they dominate. They envelop them in perpetual fog. Here is the slave, there the master. There the wealth of some, here the poverty of most. There the organized efforts of thousands produce to the profit of one man. Here the weakness of the individual seems more feeble and helpless than even in the middle of a wilderness. From this foul drain, the greatest stream of human industry flows out to fertilize the whole world. From this pure cold flows. Here humanity attains its most complete development, at its most brutish. Here civilization works its miracles, and civilized man is turned into a savage. Manchester was, in short, the first recognizable capitalist landscape, shaped entirely by unfettered greed without intervention by the state. And this kind of description would pretty much fit Pittsburgh or Bochum in 1900, Santos near Sao Paulo in the 1970s, or Manila and Bangkok or Dhaka nowadays. Yet despite all that, all these technological innovations would have been of little avail if Britain were unable to procure enough cotton. And this brings us to the sixth factor which made Britain distinctive. In the 17th and early 18th century, Britain had obtained most cotton from Turkey. But in the middle of the 18th century, it obtained ever more from India, and particularly from Western India. The rich black soils of the Indian Deccan are traditionally cotton-grown country. Historian Pamela Nightingale argued that the aggressive policy of the British towards the Maratha state was prompted primarily because they were ogling the rich cotton fields they controlled. However, India was still 5 months sailing in that age of sailing ships, and Indian cotton was expensive because it had to be fetched by bullock carts to the coast. Britain obtained some cotton from the Brazilian Maranhão, but only small quantities. And the sugar islands in the Caribbean were small and obviously devoted to sugar. So that as France declared war on Britain, the planters in the West Indies were immediately ogling sparsely populated Demerara, present Guyana, and Trinidad to lay out new cotton plantations for Manchester there. Guyana in particular witnessed an economic boom in the 90s as tens of thousands of slaves were fetched there for new cotton plantations. The abolition of the slave trade then, for a while, caused a depression in Guyana, just as in Jamaica, as the former slaves were not willing to work on the plantations any longer. But in 1838, plantation owner John Gladstone, father of the later British Prime Minister William Gladstone, hit on the idea to use indentured labourers from India for that. Still, the Industrial Revolution in Britain would have come grinding to a standstill had it not been for two things. First, the invention of the cotton gin by America's first inventor, Ely Whitney, in 1793, that revolutionized cotton production by increasing 50-fold the quantity of cotton that could be processed in a day, and that enabled more economic processing of short staple cotton that could readily be grown in the uplands of the USA. And on the other hand, the sale of the vast territory of Louisiana to the USA by the French in 1803. For as they had suffered defeat in Haiti and thus lost their main base of operations in the Americas, there was no way the French could defend Louisiana anymore against the British attack. So the French decided they better sell it off quickly to some friendly power, otherwise it would be taken by the British anyway. That sale opened up a huge territory, exquisitely fitted for the cultivation of cotton and easily accessible by the just-invented steamboat. That ushered in an economic boom in the USA. The Louisiana boom was followed by the Alabama boom or the Tennessee boom, as everything was cleared for cotton plantations. In the Tennessee Valley in Alabama, for example, where previously small peasants had raised some grain and cowboys herded some cattle, everything and everyone was removed, and the whole area by 1830 consisted of cotton plantations, so everything was removed to make place for the kind of landscape and the kind of culture of the Romantic South. Really a cotton monoculture with poor white farmers attached to feed the cotton plantations. There is this idea in the USA that the South is a primordial pre-capitalist landscape that recalls in its timeless beauty the romantic Scottish landscape that was immortalized by Walter Scott. That's actually another timeless landscape that was produced by Highland clearances in the early 19th century. This image has of course been immortalized in the greatest bestseller of all time, Gone with the Wind. And there are few historians of the South who are not seduced by that pre-capitalist vision. Yet in reality, the Old South is as much a product of industrial capitalism as Manchester was. In 1812, fewer than 300,000 bales of cotton were produced in the USA. By 1820, the amount had increased to 600,000 bales, and by 1850, it had reached 4 million, 40% of the entire exports of the USA, three quarters of which went to Manchester, and it made, on one side of the Atlantic, the fortunes of the port of Liverpool, and on the other side, the fortunes of the port of New York, since all ships departing with cotton from the South touched there, and New York monopolized maritime banking and insurances. The revenues of the cotton trade became critical for the US government revenue, that in that period almost entirely depended on custom excise. Finally, as the British imported far more cotton from the USA than they exported goods to the USA, Britain ran a deficit on its trade with the USA that the British covered by bills and credit. Those bills were basically used by the United States for large projects in the infrastructure, such as the canal building boom of the early 19th century and later on railroads. The economic development of the USA was thus by and large dependent on cotton. Yet, who was to work in all those beautiful new cotton fields? Immigrants would refuse working in the unhealthy delta of the Mississippi, and they were too expensive anyway. Now, in the 80s of the 18th century, slavery in the United States appeared on the way out. In fact, in contrast to the Caribbean or to Brazil, it had always been a rather marginal institution there, which is also why I didn't deal with it before. And in the 90s, most northern states had outlawed slavery. Yet the growth of cotton suddenly transformed slavery from a marginally profitable to the central institution for the US economy, and indeed for the world economy at large. As the great African-American leader and historian William Edgar Du Bois put it, quote, "The giant forces of water and of steam were harnessed to do the world's work, and the black workers of America bent at the bottom of a growing pyramid of commerce and industry. And they not only could not be spared if this new economic organization was to expand, but rather they became the cause of new political demands and alignments, new dreams of power, and new visions of empire. First of all, their work called for widening stretches of new, rich, black soil, in Florida, in Louisiana, in Mexico, even in Kansas. This land, added to cheap labor, and labor easily regulated and distributed, made profits so high that the whole system arose in the South with a new leisure and a new social philosophy. Black labor became the foundation stone not only of the Southern social structure, but of Northern manufacture and commerce, of the English factory system, of European commerce, of buying and selling on a worldwide scale. New cities were built on the results of black labor, and a new labor problem involving white labor arose both in Europe and in America. In 1810, the total value of slaves in the United States was rated at $316 million. By 1860, that had mounted to a staggering $3.6 billion. That's half the total gross national product of the USA. It was more than all railways, all factories, all shipping lines combined. The number of slaves in the USA increased from 800,000 around 1780 to 4 million in 1860, whereas in the 17th and the early 18th century, the USA had been a very minor slaveholding country, comparable to Suriname. By 1860, it had become by far the biggest slaving nation on earth. In other words, while the British themselves had abolished slavery, their entire industrial system had come to depend on slavery in the USA. Whereas slavery was in the USA not some time-hallowed institution going all the way back to that old and nasty 17th century, as it is commonly depicted in the USA, but was rather completely created anew by the Industrial Revolution. Now, there appears to be a kind of naive consensus amongst American historians that if the United States Congress emits a law, that means it is immediately obeyed, and that if the Congress thus abolishes or prohibits something, that is immediately the end of it. Yet, though the US Congress might outlaw trade in drugs as much as it likes, the USA is still the world's largest importer. And very similarly so, when the United States Congress outlawed slave trade in 1807 and put stiff fines on trading in slaves, that deterred slave traders as little as all the stiff fines and prison sentences it would put on drugs later on. Over the next 50 years, dozens, if not hundreds of American slave traders were still active on the West African coast. The British did maintain a naval squadron in Sierra Leone to combat the slave trade, but they could do little against ships flying the neutral American flag. In the one, and apparently only book to discuss that issue, since all other historians since have seemingly assumed that if Congress had outlawed the slave trade, there wasn't any slave trade anymore, Du Bois estimated that at least 15,000 slaves yearly were fetched from West Africa to the United States. And that figure is likely far too low if I'm going by the records of the British Admiralty in Sierra Leone. If to that we add another 40,000 slaves annually fetched to Brazil, and supposedly to Cuba, of whom, however, part was sold on to the USA via Florida and via a very similar route as the route that is used in the drug trade nowadays, far more slaves were being fetched after the abolition of the slave trade from West Africa than in that bad old 17th century. Yet, despite the continuation of the slave trade, most slaves still derived from the USA itself. By 1815, domestic slave trade within the USA had become a major economic activity. Between 1830 and 1840, nearly 200,000 slaves yearly were taken across state lines. Most of the slaves sold originated in Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas, where soil exhaustion in agriculture decreased demand for slaves, and that now proudly used to call themselves the breeding states. The internal slave trade became the largest enterprise in the South outside of the plantations, and probably the most advanced one in its employment of modern transportation, finance, and publicity. It developed its very own unique language, with terms such as breeding wenches and fancy girls for slave ladies who were particularly fertile and thus gave good returns. Those slaves, young black men and women, ripped from the seaboard, writes historian Ira Berlin about them, were the shock troops of the Cotton Revolution. By the time they arrived at some forbidding piece of prairie that only the most optimistic owners believed could be converted into a plantation, those would-be cotton cultivators, most bare children, had experienced all the nightmares of the Middle Passage. I recall 90-year-old ex-slave Jonathan Bost, interviewed during a massive project during the New Deal, to have unemployed do some useful historic research by interviewing ex-slaves, from which I will quote a few examples more. I recall the speculators coming through Newton with the slaves. Those poor critters froze to death. They always came along in December, so that they would be ready for sale in January. Many times I saw 4 or 5 of them chained together. They had not enough clothes to keep a cat warm. The women never wore anything but a thin dress. I've seen ice balls hanging from the bottom of their dress, just like sheep before they are sheared. They wore no shoes. They just ran around along the ground, all sheared with ice. The speculators stayed in the hotel, and they put the knickers, sorry for the word, but that's normal at the time, they put the knickers in the quarters like dogs. All through the night, I heard them moaning and praying. End quote. Grieving for their future, many slaves took their own lives. Others died when they could not maintain the feverish pace of those marches. New Orleans became the national slave market and port. It became the wealthiest and the 4th largest city of the USA, entirely based on slave trade and business associated therewith, as slaves were shipped from there upriver by steamboats to plantations on the Mississippi River. Indeed, it was noted at the time, a drove of slaves on a southern steamboat bound for the cotton or sugar regions is an occurrence so common that no one, not even the passengers, appear to notice it, though the slaves clanked their chains at every step. The trading season was from September to May, after the harvest. Recalled former slave Andrew Boone, 90 years old. They sold slaves just like horses. I saw a lot of slaves on the auction block. They would strip them stark naked. A knicker, card up and swelled, was considered a bad knicker and did not bring a good price. If his body was not scarred, he did. Once the trip ended, slaves faced a life on the frontier significantly different from most labor in the Upper South. Clearing trees and starting crops on virgin fields was harsh, backbreaking work. A combination of inadequate nutrition, bad water, and exhaustion from both the journey and the work weakened the newly arrived slaves and produced severe casualties. New plantations were located at river edges for ease of transportation and travel. Mosquitoes and other environmental challenges spread disease, and that took the life of many slaves. The death rate was so high that, in the first few years of hewing a plantation out of the wilderness, some planters preferred, whenever possible, to use rented slaves rather than their own. The treatment of slaves, of course, widely varied depending on conditions, times, and places. There were undoubtedly a great many humane, paternalistic slaveholders. And furthermore, keeping the slaves healthy and fit to work was in the interest of the owners themselves. Yet slaves were still punished by whipping, shackling, hanging, beating, burning, mutilation, or imprisonment. Punishment was most often meted in response to disobedience or perceived infractions, but sometimes abuse was carried out simply to reassert the dominance of the master or the overseer. Treatment was usually harsher on large plantations, often managed by overseers and owned by absentee slaveholders, in contrast with small slave-owning families where the close relationship between the owner and slaves sometimes resulted in a more humane environment. Most states denied slaves the opportunity to learn to read and write, a prohibition unique to American slavery. Yet, as one slave recalled, "I can't read and write, but they learned us how to count in this way. Odd is an odd, and a figure is a figure. All for the white man, nothing for the nigger." Medical care for slaves, limited in terms of medical knowledge, was generally provided by other slaves or by slaveholder family members. Many slaves possessed some medical skills needed to tend each other and used folk remedies brought over from Africa. Slaves were prohibited from associating in groups with the exception of worship, a reason why the black church is such a notable institution in black communities. And the church was useful for the slaveholders as well. For, the missionaries taught the slaves, quote, God is the moral governor of the universe and the ruler of nations. The father of the families and the owner of the slaves are thus each in their own sphere the head of moral government, in subjection to God for the good of society, the happiness of people and the glory of God's name. Slave women in the United States were at high risk of rape and sexual abuse. Some slaves fought back against sexual attacks, and some died resisting them. Others carried psychological and physical scars from those attacks. Ricard Post, quote, plenty of the colored women have children with the white men. She knows better than not to do what he says. Then they take these very same children, who they have made by their own blood, and they make slaves of them. If Mrs. finds out, she raises revolution, but she hardly finds out. The white man is not going to tell, and the nigger woman afraid to tell. So they just go on hoping things won't be that way always. In sum then, as Karl Marx summed it all up, without slavery there would be no cotton. Without cotton there would be no modern industry. It is slavery which has given value to the colonies. It is the colonies which have created world trade, and the world trade is the necessary condition for large-scale machine industry. And so, Frederick Douglass, another of those redoubtable and remarkable African-American intellectuals, who from a slave became the first African-American to be nominated to the vice presidency, he makes a very brief appearance in the 1989 movie Glory, Frederick Douglass could exclaim in 1852, quote, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days of the year, the cross injustice and cruelty of which he is the constant victim. To him your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty is an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your shouts of liberty and equality a hollow mock. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety and hypocrisy, a thin field to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States. Go search where you will. Roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of everyday practice of this nation. And you will say with me that, for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without rival.